Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged, brought to you by Hedgeye Risk Management. Today is April 28th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everyone. As we did last week, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford. Christian, how are you this afternoon?
Good. How are you, Neil? Are you keeping sane during quarantine?
I am. I have plenty of coffee, which now I've learned to do myself. You know, I can do any kind of, you know, latte, espresso. I've become quite expert now that all the Starbucks are shut down.
I've been perfecting my French press technique.
Well, I know. We all have. At least we're not working on any stronger drinks than that yet. So we'll see where that goes. So today we want to, do some of our usual and something new. We're going to talk about markets. We're going to talk about COVID-19. Just a reminder to all of you, please tune in to our Thursday broadcast at 12:30. We're going to, I think this time, look very heavily at strategies for dealing with it, not just containment. We're going to look in detail at that, but also the pursuit of herd immunity, which is still being talked about rather actively by health officials in Sweden, the Netherlands, no longer so much in the UK. We're going to look at that. There's actually a very good case made for each of those strategies, neither one of which we're really following here in the United States. We are going to talk about the growing size of government, some alarming statistics about how suddenly Big Brother is here, I guess you could say, by any kind of fiscal measure, how we will deal with all the new public debt, relations with China, and how the Democratic Party under Joe Biden may be less of a break with Trump than you think, and it may even be a break in a different direction. So we'll talk about that. Incoming indicators, as usual, in the U.S. and abroad, closer look at Europe. And then finally, if we have time, Christian, I'd like to take a look at our Newswire item that we did yesterday on the gentrification of the U.S. soldier. I think we've seen an enormous rise in the prestige and trust in the military as an institution over the last 30, 40 years, going against the declining trust in almost every other public institution. And it's been accompanied by a higher caliber of soldier. The millennial soldier of today, those who have been recruited from the late 90s, the OOs, who are now actually moving well into their officer various, captains and even colonelcies now, represent soldiers of a different background. And we're going to talk a little bit about that as well if we have time. So there we are. So maybe we can talk first, kind of get into markets. I think that's always a good place to start.
All right. Well, over the last five market days, the S&P 500 is up 1.96%, and the global Dow is up 0.89%. As for volatility, the VIX closed yesterday at 33.07. If you remember on our last podcast five market days ago, it had been hovering in the mid-40s range, so it has come down a little bit.
Yes, well, that's, definitely coming down. Still hardly tranquil. We'll know that when it gets back to the, under 15 or into the 12 or 11. But I think that'll be a long time before we see that. It's interesting that we see this continued very gentle slope. I think we had one down day early in the week, and then it's been gently up from then. And once again, we see the rest of the world not quite so bullish. It's amazing how long we've seen that pattern. Well, what does COVID have to do with all this? I think you could say that the markets have been buoyed by the fact that new cases are decelerating around the world and in the United States. And, you know, even deaths seem to be down this last week. So everyone's getting enthusiastic about the idea of opening up. The economy for business. And this is definitely, you know, feeding the narrative of the, you know, V-shaped recession. That's, I think, the only way you can make sense of the relatively mild market response to these absolutely horrendous economic indicators that are coming in. The market expects immediate and total recovery with no second wave. The market expects limitless stimulus support from Congress and the Fed. And I think another thing is, and I've heard this from many investors, I think many people in the market who recall 2008, 2009 sort of think, you know, I sold too early. I sold at the trough. I should have held on. You know, it did rebound back. I would have been better if I had just held during that entire thing, because after all, during the aftermath of the Great Recession, the S&P continued to rise further than ever before. What's interesting to me is that no one actually allows for the possibility, which we've seen in almost every other country around the world, that maybe the next recovery won't go back to where it did before, right? Think of Japan. Think of France. Think of the UK, Spain, Italy. I mean, you can go down the world, right? Many of these markets peaked. Well, Japan, of course, peaked back in 1990. The Nikkei has never gone back there. And many of these European countries peaked in 2000, 2008, never really returned back there. But Americans are spoiled. You know, we always think we have a right to be, you know, pretty soon better than ever, right? You never bet against America.
Right.
Well, that's a that can be a self-fulfilling prophecy, but that that can also be a big mistake if you're entering into a different kind of decade, for example, like the 1930s. You know, as all of our listeners know, I do not expect an immediate and total recovery with no second wave. And I do think that May is going to be the eye of the hurricane, so to speak. I think we're going to see opening ups in May. People are going to be very optimistic. We're going to continue to see relatively low new infections and deaths. But I do think inevitably you are going to get a reacceleration in the R-naught. It's going to be above one. It's already still above one in most states, but it's going to get significantly above one. And I think where you're going to have the time of reckoning is in June. I think what's going to happen as we get to the end of May and June, not only will all the numbers finally be in for GDP, and then for a second month, we'll have employment numbers, which will be properly horrendous. But we'll begin to see infections rise again, as they almost must. The only reason they wouldn't is if we are reaching herd immunity in any particular localities, which I do not see. And if there is one thing, Christian, that we are focusing on in our COVID report, I think it's these plethora of new serum antibody tests, which are really giving us a better look at that. We took a look at that last week.
Yes.
We found in three different studies, two in California, one in Colorado, that it's somewhere between 3% and 5%. Interestingly, this new one in New York, which showed 14% for the state of New York and something like, I can't remember, 19% or 20% in New York City.
It was 20%.
20% in New York City.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, that reflects the incredibly worse severity of the infection in New York City. In fact, the publicly reported cases per capita are 6 to 7 times higher in New York City than anywhere else in America. So you'd almost, you know, that's your multiplier. You know, you go from 3 to 20, you know, 6 to 7 times, right? Yeah. And similarly, the same ratio for New York. New York State is the publicly confirmed cases per capita about 3 to 4 times higher than the rest of the United States, which gets you from about 3% or 4% to 14%. New York is a very, very unusual part of the country, but it still is nowhere near herd immunity. So New York itself, and I think, you know, Mayor de Blasio knows this, Governor Cuomo knows this, they still need to fear a second wave even in New York. And if New York has to fear a second wave, well, you know, every other place in the United States better prepare for that. And if we have no other policy except simply raising or lowering total population-wide mitigation, we have no strategy. And obviously, we're going to talk about that some more.
If you think of those numbers, Neil, just, you know, 20% of people in New York City had the antibodies. That means 80% didn't and could still get sick again, really showing how that second wave could come back.
Well, it could come back. And I think if you're dealing with something like, you know, an R out of about 2.5 or 2.6 with a totally unconstrained population, you need about something like 60 or 70% immunity to stop transmission, you know, stop right. any spread. But obviously, anyway, we're no longer near that. Yeah, go ahead.
No, keep going.
I don't know. So I did want to talk about the return of big government here. And some of these numbers I find just astounding. The U.S. deficit, these numbers are just out by the CBO, is going to be, and just hold on for these numbers, is going to be 18% of GDP in 2020, according to the latest CBO expectations, and 10% in 2021. So, in other words, that's going to be a growth recovery year, right, in the current projections. We're going to be at 10%. That was the peak disaster year during the 2009-2010 recession, right? 18% of GDP. That exceeds, that will exceed, assuming the CBO is right, any year in American history except 1943, 1944, and 1945, the peak of America's engagement into a total war in which we had military fronts going in every corner of the world, right? And we basically mobilized this entire nation to become a factory of munitions and sending, you know, what, 12, 14 million Americans abroad to fight. So that, I think, is an astounding statistic. The U.S. debt to GDP, which was 79% at, and now, again, this is a net figure. So this is net. This is not your total GDP. I know people sometimes get confused by these numbers, but this nets out, you know, internal accounts like Social Security. So it just looks like at U.S. debt, held by the public as a share of GDP was 79% at the end of fiscal year 2019. It's expected to be 108% at the end of FY 2021. And by the way, that 108%, if it's true, will exceed every other year in American history. We will be absolute historical record because it turns out that at the end of fiscal year 1946, at the end of World War II, we were at 106% of GDP. So isn't that interesting? Well, you ask, you know, why weren't we bigger at the end of World War II? Well, because we started out with much less debt in the 1930s. And again, we had more fiscal space going into World War II, right? So which was enabled us to fight the war without necessarily cutting a lot of other stuff. And this gets into my larger fears for any worsening of the crisis we have now, is that ultimately we're going to run out of fiscal room until we start cutting other stuff. Because right now, we're going into this crisis with government already burdened, you know, a very large percentage of GDP, maybe not quite on the scale of Europe, but then again, we might not have to, you know, we might have to take on greater burdens than governments in Europe. We will see. Anyway, that's where we are. Interestingly, Christian, and I know you've helped me track down this data, and we've written about it together. Both parties now favor bigger government, and this is different from back in 2009 when the Republicans, you know, the Democrats were in favor of it, but the Republicans definitely weren't. Now, Republicans and Democrats are both on the same page. Bigger government, you know, shore up our businesses, give us benefits, make sure we're held harmless by this thing. We're not responsible, after all. And for many people on the right, this was a plandemic anyway. You know what I mean? Bill Gates was behind it all. And, you know, you manufactured this thing just to torture, you know, red zone America. So, you know, at least to hold us harmless, right? There's a little bit of victimization there. So we've gone from... You know, Donald Trump, who is famous for "You're Fired," you remember that in his TV show,
The Apprentice.
The Apprentice, and now apparently it's "You're Furloughed." You know, okay, not really fired, right? You're just furloughed. You know, we'll put you on benefits. And you don't really have to resign. You'll still get your health benefits and all that. We have a very different era, I think you can say, right? There we are. A question I get asked a lot, and maybe we'll devote a future podcast more to this question, is how are we going to get out from this, right? We have all this massive increase in public debt. And how do you get out from under public debt? And obviously, there are many different ways that we've done historically. One way we've done it is simple GDP growth. That's certainly how we did it after World War II to a large extent, just simple real GDP growth. You know, just the real economy gets a lot larger. Another way we've done it is inflation. To the extent that you're selling nominal bonds with, you know, nominal interest rates, you can inflate your way out. That kind of, you know, takes value away from your creditors. You can also engage in financial repression. That is to say, you can sell government debt at very low interest rates to your own citizens and then have a regulatory system and perhaps a global regulatory system that prevents citizens from accessing higher interest rates abroad or in other assets. That's also something that we did throughout the 1940s, certainly during World War II, during the 40s and 50s and 60s, and finally that unraveled very famously in the 1970s and 1980s, you know, led to interest rates and inflation rates going through the ceiling and also to several big busts of banks, which got caught in that whiplash. But here's my point. A lot of these things are no longer available to us, right? Financial repression would be very difficult to do today unless we go back to a Bretton Woods and, you know, an kind of a gold exchange system. And we basically banned most international flows of capital. I mean, today, for instance, people get around financial repression by investing in all kinds of weird things, you know, even Bitcoin. But we would have to sort of disallow that. We would have to be a completely different kind of regulatory regime. Inflation, well, we could certainly do that. But interestingly, we have tips out there which are available for people. And a lot of government spending now is indexed to inflation. So a lot of the advantages in the past, during World War II when we had inflation or the late 1940s, people don't remember that. There was no inflation indexing of Social Security benefits. So one of the things you did was everything was nominal. So with inflation, what happened is all of your contracts, all of your benefits were all fixed nominally. So when you had inflation, it just represented a cutting of the real value of the benefits. So that was hugely beneficial, right, for the federal government. A lot of federal spending now is in one way or another indexed, even wages to some extent. Well, you can monetize it, right? I mean, that's one thing you can do. The Fed can buy it all up. And then the question is, well, what's that going to do to inflation? And I would say that's a question I get asked a lot. And I think I've opined on that in a couple of last podcasts. And I do think that if this crisis goes on for a while, and as if I believe that we will have significant infections, this will last even without infections, even without a distinct second wave. We are going to be running on three out of six cylinders. Just look at China right now. I mean, they're still like running on sort of, half speed, right? Consumers aren't coming out as before. They're not riding in the subways. Businesses aren't reopening entirely. Partly this is due to the government's continued controls. People's temperatures are getting checked going in every building. Everyone has to have that app that says green. I mean, people are being checked a lot at intersections and so on. But also, it's people's fear. And this isn't just government policy. People get afraid. No one wants to get infected. So this is enormously slowing down China's economy, even when China, in many, if not most cities, is trying to give the green light to go ahead. I think we're going to have the same problem in the United States. A lot of these restaurants will try to come back. But I mean, if you're only filling one of every other seat and one of every other table, what are your profit margins going to be? I mean, most restaurants weren't all that profitable even when they were crowded. Well, they're not going to be profitable now. We're going to have a lot of businesses go under. We're going to have tremendous restructuring of our economy, even under a good scenario. So here's where I come out on this. I think we're again in the eye of the hurricane. I think the other half of the hurricane will show up at the end of May and in June, as we begin to see the durability of what we're facing. I think we're going to see a huge rise in bankruptcies. We're going to see risk premia rising. The financial sector, which has been so hit, is not going to want to lend as much or on the same terms. So I think you're going to see as well demand contraction, and you're going to see supply side contraction. This is something, again, we haven't seen in other recessions going all the way back to 1974, 75. But we're going to see huge supply side constraints. Particularly if, and I believe they will, these benefits continue. That is to say, we are going to have these extended unemployment benefits. We're going to have the federal, kicker on top of that. Be a lot of people who are still going to be paying to stay home. And then ultimately, and I think this is the biggest thing people aren't paying attention to, I believe we're going to enter, as we did in the 1930s, a long-term reabsorption of GDP by non-market household transactions. We have entered over the last 30 years, and particularly over the last decade, what has often been called a blow-dryer economy. I've talked about that before, right? We pay each other to blow our hair. We pay each other to fix our food. We pay each other to do all of this stuff, which once upon a time was done within households. What is America rediscovering with the lockdown? It's interesting. We've written a little bit about this, Christian, about all the millennials are coming home, more than ever to these huge extended family households. People are doing things for each other. They're cooking their own food. They're washing their own clothes. They're doing all kinds of things at home within the household economy, like we've been doing since the beginning of time, right? And I believe,
cutting their own hair.
like, yeah, there you go. Dry. Well, you just don't blow your own hair or something like that. But my point is that this has already been a drag, in my opinion, in the recovery, the post Great Recession, post GFC recovery. I think it's now going to be huge. I think we're going to reintroduce what I've often talked about is the renaissance of the extended family. Is going to enter a whole nother stage. And I think we're going to have a much more family-oriented economy, and it's a much less market transaction economy. And a lot of the stuff we used to do, we're just not going to do. A lot of these businesses, a lot of these service businesses may never come back the same way. These could involve, in other words, a kind of path dependence. We could just develop new habits. And in a way, I think in many ways, culturally, socially, this will be good. I mean, we went from a market economy to a market society, right, where there was a price on everything. And it's not necessarily a bad thing that we learn to do things in, you know, a lot of things that are close to us personally in non-market contexts. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think we'll be, you know, just as rich as before, but it's going to be hell for market participants, right? It's going to be hell for businesses. And I do think that that was something that we really haven't experienced in America since the 30s, when we also saw that happening. Anyway, this is a long discussion, which we could go on, and there are many aspects of it. Obviously, we could explore. I think, to the extent that, you know, we have this enormous these enormous deficits, these rising debts, this could go either way politically with regard to future inflation. I could see the stimulus simply continuing indefinitely. And then ultimately what would happen, since the United States is the creator of the dollar is a world currency, is it ultimately would see is the beginning of inflation, and we simply export that inflation to the world, right? We could see sort of a global inflationary wave. That would cause dislocations, that would cause problems, that would certainly cause a huge crash in bond markets. Or you could see it going the other way. You could see a political stop. This is something the Fed is always worried about, that in the middle of a recession, when you're running enormous deficits, that politically Congress decides, okay, that's enough. We all remember what happened in 2011 and 2012, when Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, made a deal to actually cut back on the deficit. You know, which is odd, right? At the depths of the recession, we decided to cut fiscal stimulus, and then when we're riding high, at the very peak of the recovery in 2017 and 2018 under Trump, we decided to rev up the fiscal stimulus. I mean, this is why, in my opinion, the political cycle is not healthy when you overlay it on the economic cycle, because we're politically more likely to run deficits at the worst time, right? At the peak of the economic boom, and we're most willing to cut back at the trough. That goes against everything that economists say, but it's unfortunately what we tend to do.
Neil, do you see one party is might be more apt to want to cut back, or do you think it'll be both of them?
I don't know. I think the Republicans will definitely be on the cutback side, as they were with the Tea Party back when Obama was president. They will certainly probably be that party if Joe Biden gets elected in 2020. You know, there you go. I do think it's a reality, and I do think, and even the 1930s, you could say, was kind of bedeviled by that problem. You know, FDR was a one-party president, practically. He had a lot of popularity, but he couldn't do everything. And there was a lot of stimulus that he couldn't engage in. There were a lot of constraints still on how much power he had. One thing I did want to move on to and talk a little bit about was, and this was actually prompted by a few recent stories that have come out as people begin to talk about Joe Biden as president, and that is the big turnabout for Democrats on their attitudes toward China. It's very interesting that when Trump became president, he, you know, suddenly, you know, wanted to... suddenly pointed out that, you know, China had a trading system going, which was very disadvantageous to American workers. And he wanted to, you know, impose these tariffs. He suddenly had this very belligerent new view. He was certainly against any new trade deals. And we sort of think that, okay, the Democrats were kind of pro-China. They were kind of doves, you know, they thought we could all get along and so on. But interestingly, I think that missed a lot of the story, because on the other hand, on the extreme left, of course, with Bernie Sanders, they didn't want any trade deals either, right? So in their own way, they supported Trump in that, at least in that extent. And what you've seen since then, actually, is even the moderates in the Democratic Party have turned against China. You know, they've turned against China on you know, what they've been doing in the South China Sea, how they're bullying their neighbors, how they're oppressing their own people, what they've been doing in Hong Kong. And you see this particularly in Joe Biden, who probably has had more contact with Xi Jinping than any other leader in the world. Remember that when Xi Jinping became, you know, the number one leader, I believe it was in 2011 or 2012, even before then, Joe Biden was regularly visiting to him. Xi Jinping was a frequent visitor to his house. I mean, this was Joe Biden's specialty. You know, with you know, as vice president, is dealing with relationships with China, and you know, Obama was supposed to have this pivot to Asia and all that stuff. And so Biden knows Xi Jinping intimately, and it's fascinating to see that recently he's been out and out calling Xi Jinping a thug. I mean, he's using words that Donald Trump would never use. And I think that Biden is promising to bring to the White House a whole new human rights side to the relationship with China, a much more charged and polarizing attitude than Trump has done. And I have no doubt that China would immensely prefer that Donald Trump be reelected rather than Joe Biden be reelected. You know, Trump is always very careful to say that, you know, I don't really care about Hong Kong and Tibet and the Uyghurs and the Khazars and, you know, all those people, because I just want to get a deal done. I don't think the Democrats are going to be inclined the same way.
I don't know if you've seen, Neil, but Biden actually has an ad going out right now saying that Trump has rolled over for China.
Well,
and it's really been going pretty hard against them.
Yeah, and in some sense you can see that. I think about that a little bit when I see Steve Bannon now has a late night program where he's out rolling the war drums. I mean, you know, Steve Bannon is a huge, fierce advocate of the idea that the United States is on a huge collision course with China, and that we're, you know, practically at war. It's sort of an undeclared war. And I don't know, it's a lot of ironies in politics when you think about it. I know that he's had a number of, you know, sort of neoconservative policy experts on late at night. And anyway, it's often gone through my mind that it's funny how the tables kind of come around occasionally. Speaking of China, there was one item that I want to bring up before we move on. I know we have a bunch of other business. China is introducing a virtual currency, a digital currency, what they call a CBDC, which is a central bank digital currency. They're already in trials. This is basically, it's going to bypass the bank. So basically, an individual, when they have money in a bank, can actually put it into a central bank digital currency wallet. And it will be, you know, they won't necessarily earn any interest on it, but they could be completely bypassed the banks, and they can actually do digital transactions, costless digital transactions with businesses. So the whole efficiency and allure of a digital currency has arrived, but you'd have to say it's arrived, Christian, it as an almost anti-Bitcoin. I mean, this is about as opposite as Bitcoin as you can think, because this is not, you remember Satoshi Nakamoto, his Bitcoin was based on the premise that he wanted a currency where individuals would have to trust no one. I mean, that was the whole premise, of course, of the blockchain and all the rest. This is definitely only one person you can trust, Big Brother. And by the way, it's the only person you're going to be allowed to trust. I said from the beginning, and the reason I was always pretty bearish on Bitcoin, is that the governments would never allow it to become very popular, because governments could not survive in a world where individuals' transactions could not be monitored and tracked, right? I mean, just I mean, forget the issue of fraud. I mean, just look at the issue of tax evasion. I mean, this is one thing that governments everywhere since the beginning of time need to know. how wealthy are you and what are you spending your money on, right? So there you are. And it is ironic. And I said at the very beginning that I thought if the U.S. finally introduces a successful digital currency, it would have a name like Fedcoin, right? I mean, the Fed would introduce it.
Right.
It would be top down. It'd be extremely efficient. It'd be much more efficient per transaction than, this decentralized blockchain idea. But anyway, there you have it. It's actually being introduced, and China may be the first central bank to introduce it. With that, why don't we move on? We risk getting behind time here, so why don't we move on to some of the economic indicators around the world that came out this week?
Yeah, well, let's start with the U.S., where it seems every indicator that comes out breaks a new record. Thursday, we got the market PMI flashes for April. Manufacturing, it was down from 48.7 in March to 36.9 in April. That's its steepest decline in 11 years. For services, for April, we're at 27. It was expected to be 31.5, so that was a little bit off the mark. Composite was at 27.4 for April. And then we had a huge drop in the Kansas City Fed Manufacturing Index. That came in at minus 62 for April. That is its lowest reading since the series began in 2001. Another record low for the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index. That came in at minus 73.7 for April.
I thought it was already down in March. What was it in March?
In March, it was down minus 70.
Oh, I
then
see.
For April, it was minus 73.9.
Still contracting.
Still breaking records.
Yeah, and it's interesting, unlike a PMI, that's its sort of absolute level of contraction. It's not compared to the previous month. But that is, that's really horrendous. I find it amazing, services with a two handle. I mean, we're talking about something in the 20s. I never thought I would ever see a PMI in the 20s. But yeah, there you go.
Well, I know we had been talking about, if you go over to Europe, in the Eurozone, they also had their market PMI flashes, and their services was 11.7 for April.
Jesus. So that's just basically, basically everyone is just shut down. I mean, there's basically no one that's reporting anything that's improved. And then I noticed that the composite PMI flash in Europe for April was 13.5, and that includes manufacturing.
Correct. That is.
That's all the Eurozone, right?
Right. That is the whole Eurozone right there. That's an all-time low, too.
Wow. If that's the whole Eurozone, I would hate to ask what Italy and Spain are. They would have to be at the... I can't even imagine what would be lower than that.
I know. We're still waiting for some of those numbers to come out. I know France's service PMI flash was at 10.4.
Well,
so
that's...
There's that.
Yeah, you're getting close to a zero handle there. That is amazing. Amazing. But I noticed that France, the manufacturing PMI was still in the 30s, albeit low 30s, 31.5, right?
Yes, correct.
Wow. Okay.
So that's a little bit better, but
what else do you see around the world?
In China, industrial profits year over year is minus 36.7% for March. So that was another big number.
Wow. That's amazing.
I was going to say Japan, we also got some PMI flashes, and their manufacturing was 43.7 for April, so that's looking better than what
they're still,
Europe has had.
Yeah, they're still going to work. I mean, Japan is just not shut down at all the same way, although that may change.
Yeah, as it gets worse there, that could see that in coming months.
But I see services is down in the low 20s, right?
Right, that's services 22.8 for April and composites 27.8.
Yeah.
So,
you know, it's odd. I think the very kind of extremity of these numbers almost reinforces the V-shaped narrative. It's fascinating how that works psychologically. I think a lot of people are thinking that's just so absurdly, ridiculously low. This has to be V-shaped, right? It's almost like,
right,
you know, we push that spring way down. It has to come back next month. I think narratives are very, very powerful. And by the way, there's an interesting book out that came out late last year by Robert Shiller, one of my great, you know, heroes. And he does the, you know, Shiller's, you know, cyclically adjusted PE and a lot of other interesting things. But he did a book last year on the importance of shaping economic narratives and how economic narratives, once they get defined, have an extraordinary hold on how markets interpret things. And I think that's what you see initially. I think that will disintegrate over time, but I think you see the hold of this narrative right now. And it's almost, as the numbers get even worse, perversely, it almost reinforces the narrative, but well, of course, this can't be, you know, this can't indicate actual economic conditions, right? This is sort of an artificial thing. So there you go. Well, you know, interesting. Where do we go? Where do we go from there? I think we have a couple things to say about Europe. I know you had some interesting observations. I was talking to you before the call on what we see politically going on in Europe.
Yeah, well, you know, last week we talked about that in the U.S. we see governors seeing a large rise in their approval ratings, but in Europe we're seeing this with a lot of their leaders. If you look from February to April, Boris Johnson's approval rating is up 18 points, Macron's is up 10 points, Conte is up 11, Merkel 11. Really, the only person that you see whose approval rating is declining is actually in Brazil, was Bolsonaro.
Yeah, Bolsonaro is down, and Obrador, AMLO, and Mexico. Here's what I find interesting: the leaders that had the draconian policies, and this is a little bit counterintuitive, but the leaders who demanded a lot of sacrifice are seeing the highest approval, the highest approval elevations. Obviously, it also helps to nearly die. So there you get, you know, you get Boris Johnson. You know, it's a little bit like Reagan getting shot, you know, shortly into his presidency and almost dying. You know, he got a huge, you know, approval rating hit on that. But it's the sense of sacrifice and that sense of solidarity. It fascinates me. We've talked about this before. Trump has had a small bump. But actually rather small compared to other crises in American history and these other leaders that you see around the world. It's more similar to some of these, you know, Latin American countries that haven't done as much. But, you know, there you see it. And then I noticed you had some observations here similarly, kind of a more interesting because he's a little bit of a Trump-like figure, and that's Scott Morrison in Australia.
Yeah, so he came in March. His approval rating was at 41%, and by today, it is at 59%. So he has seen a huge bump, and he wasn't doing very well.
Well, he wasn't. He just barely got elected. He was a surprise. No one expected him, and he was considered to be a little bit of a Trump-like appeal. You know, he hated global warming, and he sort of supported a lot of the energy industries in the rural areas of Australia. He was hugely hated by, you know, Australia's blue zone and the cities and the young, but he squeaked by. And interestingly, though, he has led, unlike, you know, I don't know, you know, Trump and AMLO and Bolsonaro and all the rest. He's not sort of trying to undermine a vigorous response. Instead, he's basically saying, I want a government of all talents. I'm listening to the scientists. And he's trying to do what they're doing in New Zealand, as well as, you know, Taiwan and Hong Kong and all the rest. He's trying to actually pursue total containment, to actually get rid of the virus and to track every instance of it and to keep it from growing, keep it ever from becoming a problem. And he is he is acquiring real popularity in his effort to do so, I guess. Is that right?
That's right. He's taking more of a New Zealand approach, and I think this was pretty unexpected from him. You know, it's in times of crisis, it's time to show what you got.
Yeah, it is time to show what you got, and, you know, there you go. So what else have you got? I saw Giuseppe Conte. As you know, this is Salvini's favorite punching bag. You know, this is the Democratic Party, and Salvini's Lega has been beating him in every regional election now for 2 years, except he barely lost this last one near in the region of Bologna. But Conte finally is getting a big boost in popularity due to, again, this traumatic crisis for Italy, right? He's gained in the polls, and Matteo Salvini is sort of doesn't quite know what to do. He sort of attacks Conte at times, and then at times he allies with Conte in battling Brussels, right? So this is Italy against, you know, those are Eurozone tyrants.
Yeah, it's an interesting place for Conte, because I feel like the media is still being pretty rough on him. He's still getting some attacks from his opponents, but he's got 71% approval rating, and that's his highest ever. So I, you know, this has helped him.
He does have the problem, though, with his support from the Five Star Movement. By the way, the Five Star Movement is obviously still participating in a ministerial level in Conte's government. And the Five Star, one appointee from the Five Star is actually serving in Brussels. And the Five Star, interestingly, is very pro-China. In fact, they get a lot of money from China. A lot of the world is complaining about this. You know, China loves to sort of bribe people. They make people feel important. They give them titles and they give them money and they fund whatever they're doing. And the Five Star has a lot of China money. And interestingly, I don't know if you saw this in the news, but the EU is about to issue a report about how badly China has managed the COVID-19 crisis. And the language was hugely toned down after China's objection. And apparently, it was the five-star appointee in Brussels who insisted on all the toning down. So, you know, the world faces this problem, right? You know, China loves to ingratiate itself with kind of money and prestige. You know, you be a friend of ours and we'll be nice to you. It's interesting how China works, but you see that there. I see you have Israel has been, we'll just look at Israel and South Korea and then we'll move on here.
Yeah, so Israel has created a unity government. If you remember, they've had many elections in the last year and they can't come to agreement, but Netanyahu and Gantz, they will both serve as prime minister. Netanyahu will serve for the first 18 months, and then Gantz will serve for the next 18 months. This is the agreement they came to, so they don't have to go back to the polls. They've also signed legislation that no legislation unrelated to COVID can be presented for the first 6 months.
Yeah, well,
so they really want to focus on the
take
virus.
Take it from me, BB in 18 months will not step aside. I guarantee you that.
Yes.
I think it's an arrangement of convenience. I think he wants to stay in power forever. The last thing I noticed was that South Korea, Moon Jae-in, won a huge victory. Again, here's a guy, again, a COVID-19 hero. Here is a guy, once again, Christian, stumbling, you know, that things weren't going very well with North Korea. He looked bad. Things weren't going at all well for the South Korean economy. Right. And he was a guy who was actually suffering in public opinion, suddenly took a very strong strand on COVID-19, was able to contain that explosion of infections in the South, has implemented a strict policy, but now a policy that definitely seems to work. And wow, did he get a huge ratification from the voters.
Yes, and if you that election was their biggest turnout since 1992. So people were there to show their support. This was...
Yeah, that's incredible.
I think they won 180 seats out of 300.
Right, right. Well, there you go. You know, time is beginning to run out of it, on us. I did want to spend some time talking about the incredible elevation of, you know, if there are two institutions that have actually gone up in public trust, you know, since the 1970s and 1980s, while all other, you know, institutions have gone down, practically from, you know, Congress to the media to the presidency to just about everything else. It's two of them. One of them is technology, much more highly thought of by Americans, particularly by, you know, millennials above all, of course. I think they worship that, and to some extent Xers. I don't know about boomers. Boomers are always suspicious of technology. But anyway, technology is much more trusted. And the U.S. military. And I do think this is interesting from a turning's perspective, because I often think in terms of survival, you always want to think if things really get tough, who is America that could ultimately just cede all power to make its decisions, right? I don't know. I think some kind of a combination of, you know, Google and the Pentagon, right? Let them run America for a while, you know? And it gets back to a theme that I've often talked about, and that is the millennials' fundamental disaffection often with sort of liberal democracy as we know it. After all, what's democracy done for them? It's created this government which gives enormous benefits to the old. It saddles them with debts. It doesn't really do anything particularly to raise their living standards. And we've talked about in the past, Christian, how millennials are a little lot easier in their feelings toward China than older Americans.
Yes.
That's true, not only in America, but around the world. Western millennials are much more favorable, not necessarily they like China, but they're more favorably inclined to a government which, you know, maintains order, invests a lot in the future, certainly, you know, favors technology, favors order. You could certainly say that.
Well, we've seen this in in surveillance technology. We've written about that quite a bit, but millennials usually aren't as bothered.
Right. Well, that's, again, trust. And it's also risk aversion. You know, if you really think the problem is community working together and you're also averse to risk, you're going to be more in favor of a, you know, a surveillance state, something we've called in much of our writing total tech, totalitarian technology, which you'd say almost every front, China is the leading edge, right? They're doing, right. I hate to say this, but they're doing, unfortunately, they're doing an incredible job with the Uyghurs, you know, and all the minorities. And they're beginning to do it in Hong Kong. They have a plan. They have a paradigm. And I think it's a real challenge for the liberal democracies of the West to come up with an alternative that can match the strengths of that system and avoid its terrible dangers. Well, with that, I think we kind of rammed it. We might get back. We have a fascinating piece. If you're a Demography Unplugged subscriber, we have a fascinating piece on the changing demographics of the U.S. military and how it's changed from boomer volunteers back in the late 1970s and millennial volunteers since the late 1990s and early 00s. We'll certainly get back to that. But meanwhile, thanks again for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Please tune in to our COVID report 12:30 on Thursday. Talk to you next week. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Demography Unplugged. Tune in next time. If you have any questions about this broadcast or have suggestions for future topics, please contact qademography@hedgeye.com. Also, if you'd like to see more of what I have to offer, visit us online at hedgeye.com and also make sure to follow me on Twitter @HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E, Generation.
Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.